Welcome to The More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. I'm Kevin Kelton. I live in Los Angeles. I'm a moderate Democrat, and my cocktail of choice today will be a full-bodied Kobe plum wine.
Excellent, Kevin. I'm DJ McGuire from Suffolk, Virginia. I am a neoconservative libertarian. I am the neoconservative wing of the Libertarian Party, or maybe the feather, and I'm sticking to my usual fireball this evening.
Hi, I'm Emily Brewer. I'm the moderate Republican that's left around this place, and tonight I'm enjoying an Argentinian white wine.
Hi, I'm Greg Matuszak. I'm your liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio. And I'm obviously the cheapskate because I have a root beer tonight. No one told me it was BYOB.
Oh, I'm that guy.
And I must be the designated driver.
And I'm Cliff Dunn, a Republican from Virginia, and I went with a glass of Madeira to start with.
Great.
Ooh. There we go.
And with 8,000 downloads a week, A More Perfect Union may just be the fastest growing political podcast on iTunes. A More Perfect Union can also now be heard on YouTube and iHeartRadio. And you can find our website with blogs and commentary at moreperfectunionpodcast.com. So this week was what I'm calling the calm before the S storm, because the week coming up is going to be the last week before Labor Day, or the last 2 weeks before Labor Day, and the last 2 weeks before what is normally the official kickoff of the presidential campaign. But I think that these are going to be two very key weeks coming up. First of all, let's start by talking a little bit about the week that has just passed, which was the Trump reset week. Ladies and gentlemen, what did you think of the events of this past week?
Well, I think it's really interesting how Trump has reset his campaign by changing campaign management, changed the tone, changed, you know, pretty much everything. And he's now a kinder, gentler Trump, and you see him out and about. I think it's a fascinating reset, but I'm still not kind of buying it. What do you think, Cliff?
I'm hopeful that it'll stick, but I want to give it a week or two to see if it does stick, because the last attempt or two at a reset, as we all know, didn't quite take.
Now, do you think that, you know, the people who love Trump, because he's the guy who says what everyone's thinking, and he's the guy who will tell it like it is, all of a sudden won't love him anymore?
I think if he's got a good team, he'll find a way to say what people are thinking within the script. Just because he was quote-unquote saying outrageous things at a given moment doesn't mean that he had to be horribly off-script or off-message.
Right.
The fact that it was off-message was certainly entertaining for the media, but
it was entertaining for everybody. Let's
yes.
be honest.
But that doesn't mean you can't build a campaign message around that.
Why can't they just send him into one of these rallies with a 20-minute script and then let him wing it for the next 20 minutes? To me, that would be the best of both worlds for him.
Well, you've seen cases where he has done that, and the thing is, when he gets off script, you always run the danger that he's going to go way off script.
Right.
He doesn't need half an hour to go, you know, to get himself in trouble. He needs 30 seconds.
Emily, DJ, what did you think of Mr. Trump's week?
I think this is a good opportunity for him. I think Kellyanne Conway, I'm just imagining how this kind of went down. I think she probably walked in and said, look, you've had fun. You got here by dumb luck. And so now here's what we're going to do. We're going to put duct tape on you. You're going to listen to me. And here's what we're going to do, or I'm walking back out. That's what I imagine it started like, because I will say that he is, I dare say it, inching his way towards trying to attempt to look presidential.
DJ?
I think this is a situation where Conway and Bannon, the Breitbart head, who is now his campaign CEO, I think what they have managed to do is that they've managed to sit him down and tell him, look, the message that got you the nomination, the message that enabled you to capture the Republican Party, was not the same thing as what has sent you off script and getting personal with Judge Curiel, getting personal with the Kahn family, et cetera, et cetera. I actually think Trump is more dangerous in this kind of scenario, because it is, from my perspective, it will be this relatively the same big government for white people message, but it will have a nice veneer to it that will look quasi-respectable. What I find more interesting about this, though, frankly, is what happens after the campaign. The only thing that Donald Trump has been consistent on is rank protectionism on trade and a willingness to constantly attempt to monetize his own brand. The Bannon selection, and I think Kellyanne Conway selection, because she was a she began in this business as a pollster. This is essentially building a Trump media network for after the election. And I think that's the real story of what happens here, is that he is looking beyond the election to see how he can continue to influence the debate, even if he loses. Obviously, if he wins, he has influence because he has power. But even if he loses, he is attempting to maintain his stamp on politics and essentially use politics as his new brand, which I think will be fine for him, but I think will be terrible for the Republican Party as a whole.
Yeah, I agree with everything everyone said. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that the media part of it, because I've been seeing a lot of discussion online about people who think that some people think this was his game all along, that he's throwing the election just to develop this new media brand that would be the new Fox. I personally don't believe that he's doing anything to purposely lose the election. I think that's nonsense. But I do see the threads of what everybody is calling the next Fox. Of course, we know he's been talking with Roger Ailes, and there's some potential that he could play a part in whatever this is. And the other thing that I find fascinating is another thing that we know about Donald Trump is he's very protective of his children. And he's got three, soon to be four, grown children, and they can't all run the existing Trump Industries. So I wouldn't be surprised if he sees this new media conglomerate that's in his head as something that he could pass down to Don Jr. or Eric as their little stake in the world.
Well, and one thing I'd like to point out is that there, you know, in talking about him building a media empire out of this, that is not mutually exclusive with him winning the election. After all, he spins off firecracker team into a replacement for Roger Ailes at Fox, and suddenly you have a pre-built, you know, audience for a media network. And if he's the winner, all the better.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things we forget, because it has been, you know, during the second party system in this country, one of the responsibilities of an incoming president was to either label or build an administration newspaper that spoke for the administration in the media world. Andrew Jackson did it with The Globe. Harrison was going to do it, but then he died. I can't remember the one that James Knox Polk used, but that was something that they did, that they said, okay, I'm the president now. Which newspaper is going to be the administration newspaper?
I was just going to say, I think George W. Bush helped launch The Onion.
Joke of the night. I like it.
But yeah, there is a long and storied history of partisan press in the U.S. and in Britain, for what it's worth. If anything, the quote-unquote nonpartisan press of the last, you know, two generations or so is an aberration.
I would agree.
Well, I guess we've got to look agree. At
it. And it frankly comes from, sorry, I'm just quickly. It comes from the assumption that so many people had in the 30s and 40s that politics basically ended, and so that therefore partisan reporting could end and we could go to nonpartisan reporting and nonpartisan government and such. It was a brilliant lie that FDR basically used to sort of put his permanent stamp on things. Two generations later, it's breaking down.
Does anybody wonder, when did Trump actually think he could win, and when did he get serious about it? Does anybody ever think he started this off for fun?
Yes.
And then had a realization?
Yes.
Because I feel that way.
Yeah. I think that his realization that he could win happened in late fall or early winter before the first primary. But yes, I don't think that he went into this thinking he was going to be a serious contender for president.
Oh, I agree. I think this was a lark. I think this was to sell more ties. But I think the more he said more outrageous things, which is what he always does if you watched any of his reality shows, all of a sudden more people cheered. And I'm going to say this. And all of a sudden there must have been that epiphany moment where he said, oh, this is going to happen. And I probably was after the first or second primary when everyone was really running scared.
And when it became clear that Jeb Bush was in fact not going to take off and that there was no one that was going to rise to that place. Yeah,
exactly. When Jeb Bush was still a contender.
And by the way,
then once he comes out.
To be fair to Trump, that's probably true for Bernie Sanders, too. He probably went into this thinking that he was going to try to move the party to the left, probably didn't think that he was going to derail the Clinton machine, and it might not have been until October or November or even into January where he thought, hey, you know what? I have a shot at winning this thing. So that happens a lot to people who run for the presidency for various motivations, and then their campaign suddenly takes bigger traction than anyone could have imagined. So, Cliff, back to you, since you are the person here who, as of this time, you know, and intends to vote for Trump, and I don't think anything has knocked you off of that, that certainly not that you've shared with us. What were your overall thoughts of the week of the Banyan selection, of this new tone? And the other new tone that everybody, I think, has noticed is his ostensible play for the black vote now. And there's various theories about what he's trying to accomplish there. But I want to hear from Cliff first.
I think there is an obvious, I mean, this line has come up a number of times, this line of reasoning, that the black vote has been taken ridiculously for granted by the Democratic Party to the point that it's basically a in-the-pocket vote in a lot of cities. And you've seen a lot of Democratic-run cities that have been horribly run. Baltimore, I'm looking at you. Detroit, I'm looking at you. Washington, D.C., I'm looking at you. And the list can go on and on. So I do think he sees an opening there. Now, the fact that he's not polling so hot among black voters, to put it mildly, is
he's, for the record, he's running fourth.
I mean,
behind Jill Stein.
Obviously, he's got a lot of room to build there. That being said, it's not an unreasonable tack for him to take.
Cliff, you are the best, by the way. I wish you were around when I would bring bad report cards home to my parents. You would have been the guy I wanted to say, well, Greg's got a lot of room to build. And
the best, Cliff. Trump is clearly going through the motions that Republican nominees always go through every 4 years. The problem is this is something that the Republican Party only seems to notice every fourth year in a presidential election. Oh, by the way, we lose 90-95% of the black vote. Perhaps you should see to that. And what Trump is going to learn is what every other Republican nominee for president learned, is that a 2 to 3 month marketing campaign or the attempt to pay attention is not going to overturn essentially 50 years of toxic relations between the African-American community and the Republican Party. So Trump is going to go through the motions, and then he's going to get, you know, 2-4% of the black vote, whatever it is. And then the Republican Party is going to go in 2017. They will go right back to where they were in largely ignoring and not paying attention to the black vote because they don't see the short or midterm return on investment. And they're not willing to make the long term investment yet. They just aren't.
I would say that there is one indirect game that I could see him playing here, too. And I'm not sure if he is thinking in these degrees of subtlety. In fact, I'm fairly certain he isn't, though some of his staff may be. And that is, if he lobs criticisms at the Democratic handling of the black vote, maybe he can shunt some of them off into Jill Stein and or Gary Johnson's
camp. Yes.
And every black vote that doesn't go to Hillary Clinton and that goes to them is still a half a victory for him, because that's votes not in Hillary's camp.
You read my mind. I do think that that's part of his strategy. Look, his strategy is to hurt Clinton in any way possible. Obviously, he wants to win more votes, too. But it's very important to remember that Donald Trump doesn't have to get 30 or 40 or 50% of the black vote. He just needs to get 5% more than he's getting now. And if he can, like you said, bleed some of the black vote, I think an overall strategy that Republicans have always used, and I think the Trump campaign is going to magnify it this year, is they want to make things so negative and so toxic that a lot of people just go, forget it, I'm not going to waste time driving down to my polling place and standing online for 2 hours. I just don't care anymore. And, the black vote is susceptible to that, too.
The simple fact of the matter is, Kevin, and there's no real nice way to say this, and I'm a little too drunk to find it. you are a Clinton supporter, but you are also a white Clinton supporter. And every single person on this podcast is white. The experiences that I've had, the communications I've had with African-Americans, and I'm white, too, so I very clearly get this wrong, is that they have a loyalty to the Democratic Party that's been built up over the last 50 years, mainly because of the fact that, yes, we all say, well, but what has the Democratic Party really done for African Americans? African Americans can sit you down for 15 to 20 minutes and just go off and answer all those questions for you. And every single time a voter ID bill comes up, they can look up and go, that's some Democrat screaming bloody murder about it. And they can just point at the TV and go, that's what Democrats are doing for me. That's the kind of hill Donald Trump has. That's the kind of upward trajectory Donald Trump has to go up against. And the idea that he can manage to bleed to send African Americans to Jill Stein or Gary, and I'd love to see more African Americans vote for Gary Johnson, but I'm not a fool here. The simple fact of the matter is that is harder than we give it credit for, because the Democrats, for all the things that I think the Democrats have done wrong, they have made very certain that their relationship with African American voters is very, very good in a positive and in a negative way. And Donald Trump making comments about Detroit and Baltimore and Washington, even though those cities have been run into the ground, and even though he knows what happens when a Republican runs a major city, because he saw New York run under Republican leadership, good Republican leadership for 20 years, that is not going to break 50 years of relationship building that Democrats have done with the African-American community. It's going to take a lot more time than 85 days.
But again,
your
point again, super well taken. I mean, everything you're saying is right on. But again, remember, Cliff and I are talking not about the bulk of the minority vote, but just breaking off a fringe, 3%, 5%, 7%. And, especially among millennials who I don't think have that same attachment to the Clintons as the older demographic in the African American community. So, again, I hope you're right, DJ, but I fear you're not.
I think you guys are not also thinking of one other thing, and this is a small movement I've seen recently in the past 2 weeks on Facebook, that the Black Lives Matter movement is very, very split over Hillary. There's a small movement that's starting to do either vote for Gary Johnson or Bernie Sanders write-in, and I really wonder how that's going to affect as we go towards November.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Stein got a lot of press this week. She did a town hall. I still think there was an op-ed piece on thehill.com today by a woman who was one of those delegates to the Democratic convention that was there to either nominate Bernie or destroy the party. Now she's out to destroy the Democrats and, for whatever they think they're going to accomplish by supporting the Stein campaign. But I think you're right. I think there's still an undercurrent of that out there that could be a very problematic for Hillary Clinton.
Right. The race is obviously not over. Hillary's leading nationally by most polls, except for Los Angeles, by anywhere from 6 to 9 points.
Actually, probably a little less nationally now. Probably
yeah,
5 to 6.
The last three always have her at 2 to 4.
Maybe.
Yeah.
2 to 4?
Pugh was 4, Rasmussen 2, Reuters Ipsos 4.
Okay, and Nate Silver's the thing that he sends out today, his mailer said 5 to 6 on an average. So
5 to 6, right? Five to six, right? And there's one that's 9, but you're right, 5 to 6. But it's not over, so it's still a race, but it's not the only race this year. There are other races that are even almost more exciting. The Senate. The Senate.
As I can tell, there are 6 competitive races in the Senate, maybe 7, but in that range. And the Democrats only need to win 4 of those to essentially gain control of the Senate, which would be a 50-50 split.
Kevin, if one of them is Nevada, then it's 5, because Nevada is Harry Reid's seat. That's a Democratic held seat. So they need a whole Nevada and flip 4 others.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And actually, so I think there's Nevada, a couple more than that.
What were the other ones?
It's probably Ayotte, probably Portman.
Yes.
I'm going to say Toomey.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you there. Portman's going to win. Portman's up by at least 7. And as much as I like Strickland.
Hold it, Greg. Is Portman at 50%?
Oh, no, he's not.
The key for an incumbent is are they at 50%? I saw this in 1988 with the D'Amato Schumer race. D'Amato led Schumer throughout most of the campaign, but he could never get to 50%. All the undecideds went to Schumer and D'Amato lost. If an incumbent senator is not at 50%, he or she is vulnerable.
That is a gold standard.
Oh, you made my day. This is awesome.
Okay.
Well, we're not trying to make your day, but it is the gold standard. Right. And I'm going to go ahead and say the one seat that I feel like right now I could stay this far out that I feel very confident will flip is I think Katie McGinty is going to beat Pat Toomey. I think that's a done deal.
Really?
I really do. I feel confident enough.
As much as I like Pat Toomey, I would have to agree with her. I fear that he is toast.
And based on what, guys?
You know, I think there's something to be said that people get very excited about female candidates, particularly on the Democratic side. And I think that factor alone sometimes will actually help drive turnout. She's more youthful, I think, than Pat Toomey. And honestly, from what I'm hearing, her messaging is pretty solid.
Yeah, I would look at the national factors
in Kentucky last year.
Yeah, but hang on. And that's where I'm going to throw in and put in the national picture. That's Kentucky, Greg, and that was a midterm election. This is Pennsylvania in a presidential election.
I don't see a situation where Toomey wins if Trump is going down by 10 or 15 in Pennsylvania. The crossover voting patterns just don't exist now like they used to.
But there's something you guys are totally forgetting is you're going to have a ton of Republicans. They're going to feel like bad Republicans if they vote over and cross and vote for Hillary, or if they vote for Gary Johnson or, God forbid, Jill Stein. What a waste. But they are going to feel so terrible about their decision that they're probably going to split ticket.
Oh, yeah.
So there are some of these races that are not going to be totally affected by the Trump monster.
The fundamentals in Pennsylvania are still bad for Toomey. So I agree that I do think he is going down. The fundamentals are terrible for Mark Kirk. They're getting worse for Ron Johnson up in Wisconsin. For the Republicans to hold the Senate, they would just need to hang on to Florida, which they can probably do. Hang on to New Hampshire, which is a much trickier call. Hang on to North Carolina, which I don't think they'll do. I think the Democrats will sweep North Carolina this year.
Wow.
And I think North Carolina will be a Republican bloodbath this year. And I think that would be – I'm for sure that would be the fourth seat that the Democrats will need. The question of the Democrats is, can they hang on to Nevada? Because for whatever reason, Trump is outperforming in Nevada compared to a typical Republican, so that would be hard for them to do. But I think if the Democrats can hold Nevada and keep steady as they go in North Carolina, they probably will have the Senate. The question is – and given what Trump has done this week, that he may counter that. The question is, do they get a large enough margin at the presidential level to actually flip enough seats to carry the House? And that,
no.
That you have to draw an inside straight. Yeah, I agree they have to draw an inside straight, but they do have four of the cards needed for it. And the thing about gerrymandering and the thing about district drawing is, when you draw districts in your favor, you draw a whole bunch of 52-48s in your favor. They're more likely to get crushed under a wave than a typical standard neutral redistricting situation. So if Hillary Clinton wins by 2 or 3 points, the House is fine. If Hillary Clinton wins by 10 points and she has coattails, the House is in serious trouble.
I don't see the degree of coattailing. And yes, I know I was just talking about, there being a limited ticket splitting, but I don't see that degree of coattailing happening this time. Remember, we have, we have two very unpopular top candidates.
True.
And a lot of your Clinton voters would be clothespin voters, and she's under 50.
But the one thing I would throw out there is to counter Emily's comment about Republicans who would be upset about leaving Trump and be more inclined to support Republican candidates under, the Democrats have that problem too. You'll have a bunch of maybe Jill Stein voters or Gary Johnson Democrats who are going to be feeling the same things that never Trump Republicans are going to feel. They're going to wait. I have to show my progressive credentials by voting Democratic down ticket. So you're going to have countervailing forces on that. So the idea that, if I'm the Republicans and I'm worried about the ticket splitting to save the Congress, yes, I take that strategy. But Democrats are going to have that. They're going to have built-in crossover voters too, from folks who are from really angry Democrats who are going over to Jill Stein, but who will still vote Democratic for Senate or for House.
So let's just take a couple of minutes before the end of the show, because we've talked constantly about Mr. Trump, not that much about Mrs. Clinton and or the other people in the race. So, Greg, what do you think of the whole rigmarole about the Clintons saying, well, they're going to change the way they raise money for the Clinton Foundation. They're not going to take money from foreign governments. He's not going to give paid speeches from now until the election, and then should she win after the election, which I think is a big deal for him to turn down any paid speeches.
Yeah, right, exactly. But you don't see Michelle Obama taking paid speeches.
No, I think it's a good move, but, you know.
I think it's a great move. Is it a little too little, little too late?
Right.
I mean, that probably should have been put in place 10 months ago, a year, so that people couldn't be screaming about this now. But, yes, it's. These are the things that the American public wanted 10 months ago, She knew she was going to be running for office like 10 years ago. So she could have said, all right, this will be the cutoff day.
Well, you know, neither of them has given, I think, a paid speech in 2016. So it's not like they're just all of a sudden coming to this place.
Well, they've been campaigning.
But the point is they haven't done the thing that seems to irk everybody. And another point I want to
– they've been doing fundraisers.
And another point I want to sneak in here, because everybody, when it comes to this thing, they talk about, oh, the Clintons were, you know, made $100 million and they take money from – or their foundation takes money from foreign governments. Paid speeches is one way to make money. But also Donald Trump has an $8 billion industry out there that makes money in all sorts of ways. And nobody talks about what his business would be like if he were to win the presidency. I want to find out what kind of a blind trust he's going to put Trump Industries into. Not.
That would be okay. Well, he's never going to happen. Well, he's discussed that already, that he would gladly just turn over his business to his lovely daughter.
But that's not the same thing as a blind trust. You know, Dick Cheney didn't turn over his Halliburton industry business to, you know, his daughter Lynn.
Right.
Just saying, I'm going to let Ivanka run the business doesn't mean that they're not going to cash in on him being president, and it doesn't mean that foreign governments won't give them exceedingly good deals.
I agree.
So it really irks me that she gets hit on this stuff, and people talk about, and he does it on the stump. He talks about, oh, they made $100 million. Here's a guy that makes $100 million in a quarter. And, right,
but
you know,
going back, though, that's their job. Yeah, they make money talking,
right,
and they make money making speeches. That's not a bad job.
No,
it's a fee for service.
It is. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing surreptitious about it. I get sick when people say that must have been some speech that she made for $225,000. Well, it's not about the quality of the speech. Jay Leno's act. You know, he gets $500,000 to do one of those corporate gigs. It's not about the quality of the material. It's about the fact that they're landing Jay Leno, okay? And when Goldman Sachs or another company lands Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton, it's not because they're thinking that they're going to tell them something that they've never heard before. It's because it impresses their shareholders and their employees, and they can promote themselves in this way.
Well said.
In other words, Kevin,
yes.
What you're saying is the reason that they give Hillary Clinton that kind of money is because that is what she can earn them in ticket sales and further contributions and donations from other people down the line. They are making an investment in her speech. That's what you're saying, right?
Well, no, you're
right.
No. That's what you're saying. What I'm saying is
No. Hang on. You're not listening to my point. My point is that if they bring her and if they pay her $20,000 for speech, they'll get more tickets for attendees to that speech. They'll get more donations from the general public who'll say, oh, that person brought in Hillary Clinton. They are looking and they're saying, okay, paying Hillary Clinton $250,000 for this speech can earn us at least that and more in donations from the general public, ticket sales and things down the line. NFL team owners pay quarterbacks millions of dollars a year because they get ticket sales and advertising revenue. This is the free market at work, and the reason it is giving so much problems to the Clintons is because they're part of a party that is so hostile to the free market, they don't understand how it works anymore.
No, that's just – I mean, I
and
love you, DJ, but that's just
they
craziness.
Have the whole party, but you take your average Bernie Sanders supporter who – you know, I would say probably wants to, you know, take over a bunch of stuff. And the idea that somebody is earning in the space of, I'll just say, a half an hour speech, you know, 10 times what they earn in a year, that's going to hit them. Okay. Let me ask one other question on this front. And that is
very quickly, Cliff, very quickly.
The Clinton Foundation stops taking foreign money after the election. Is it just me, or does that sound like a cutoff for bidding at an auction?
No, I think you're putting the worst possible spin on somebody doing the right thing for the right reasons. But you know what? You want to do that? Go ahead, do that. Then we won't talk about Donald Trump selling, you know, ties and opening golf courses under the auspices of his presidential campaign.
here's what we got to say real quick before we kind of get off this topic, though. Is everyone acts like we don't want a successful president, okay? Or a successful presidential candidate. But, you know, they should be unapologetic about their success, but also run it through a lens to wonder what people will say about their integrity and their level of honesty in their dealings. So they should not be, you know, apologetic about their success.
Yes.
They just should know.
And you know what? One of the great tests of integrity is showing your tax returns. The Clintons have shown somewhere between 20 and 30 years of open tax returns. Donald Trump hasn't shown page one. So I am not going to sit on this podcast and let people besmirch the integrity of Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton based on stuff that they do not hold other candidates to. Okay? Go ahead, DJ.
I will simply say two things before Kevin wraps things up. One, I didn't do anything about that. I mentioned an economic argument that no one in his party can understand because they are who they are. And two, we've been arguing about integrity and such for 10 minutes, and Cliff got you so riled up you never mentioned Roy Cohn. That's a win for the Trump campaign. Wrap it up, Kevin.
And with that, listen, this has been a spirited debate, especially the last 10 minutes. I love it. And I want to thank our listeners for partaking in it. So don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. Please share our link on your Facebook newsfeed so your friends can find us too. And if you like this kind of discussion and you'd like to get involved yourself, please join us on Facebook at Open Fire. It's a political debate group you can ask to join. We're all in there, and you can be part of our discussions going forward. With that, we say good night, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, and keep drinking.